There were no stoplights. People were driving erratically, swerving all over the road, trying to avoid other cars, trying to avoid trees falling into the road. And there would be huge branches on fire, just absolutely coming out of nowhere at your car. The only light was the light of the mountain, because it was on fire, and the flames, I've never seen the flames like that.
So it was day, but it was basically dark.
Right? It was nighttime by now.
It was nighttime by then. Hallo und herzlich willkommen bei Work-Life Stories. Ich bin Mona Rüssmann und in diesem Podcast geht es um die Faszination des Neustarts. Beruflich, privat oder gleich beides zusammen. Spannende Menschen erzählen hier von ungewöhnlichen Lebenswegen und mutigen Entscheidungen. Lass dich inspirieren. Ich wünsche dir viel Freude beim Anhören dieser Episode. Los geht's! My guest in today's podcast is Bracken Armstrong. Bracken works as an emergency medicine physician in Los Angeles. And she lives with her family in Altadena, a quiet neighborhood in the greater Los Angeles area. Bracken is married, has a 15-year-old daughter, and the family were residents of the Altadena area for many generations. Mm-hmm. So this is a place that Bracken would call home for most of her life. Then January 7th of this year came, and Bracken lost her house in the so-called Eaton fire. Mm-hmm. And not only that, her parents, who lived a few blocks further down the road, also lost their home.
Yeah.
So within the course of, 4 hours, the lives of basically 3 generations were shattered.
Yes.
Among that of many other lives in the Altadena area and also in the Pacific Palisades area early this year. So this situation forced Bracken and her family into a complete restart of their lives. And this situation alone is more than most of us are facing throughout the course of their lives overall. Mm-hmm. And for Bracken, this was not the first restart, but it was mainly the third restart. Yeah. That she had to go through. So this is a life full of twists and turns, and I'm more than grateful that you are sharing some of this information and some of these stories with us. So a warm welcome to Work Life Story, Bracken Armstrong.
Thank you.
We are basically meeting for the first time in person today, which is amazing. We had a couple of talks before because, my daughter was in boarding school here for 1 year in Pasadena, which is the community close to Altadena. Mm-hmm. And Bracken was providing a home away from home for my daughter. Our daughters are good friends.
Yes.
And
I loved having her.
Yeah, it felt so good for me to know that there was someone who was taking care of her when she was outside of boarding school. So, we had a few talks and interactions before, and it felt really good that my daughter met such nice people.
Well, that's very sweet of you.
And it was great that she could connect here.
Yeah.
So these past months, Bracken, must have been unimaginable hard for you. So how are you doing today? How are you doing and how's the family doing?
I think we're doing okay. I think that we've all had to restart. And as you said, it's my third time restarting in my life. And my husband has had to restart several times in his life as well. So unfortunately, this restart is becoming muscle memory for us. And we're getting good at it. So my parents, it's been a little bit harder. My parents were in their home for 50 years. They bought the home in 1975, and then 2025 was when it burned down. It's where I grew up, and it's where they've been since. So I think it's been a little harder for them, but they are back on their feet, and we are all in the process of getting the rebuild started. So
it's been some light.
There's some light. It's been a very rough 8 months. That's an understatement. Yeah. It's been a rough 8 months.
Sounds like an understatement.
Yeah.
We meet today in in a house that looks like a home.
Yes.
So is this a temporary home? This is a rented place and you got it furnished or how did
Well, it came furnished, which was great for us because that way we didn't have to go out and quickly buy any furniture just to you know, for a rental home. But we were actually scheduled to rent this home before the fire because we were moving out of our home to do some remodeling and had already scheduled this house.
This place. Yeah.
So we were very lucky. That's one of the reasons we were so lucky after the fire in comparison to the 10,000 other families that were left homeless that night. Probably more like 14,000 families who were left homeless that night. But because we already had this place set up and it was already furnished. So
it's beautiful.
Yeah. So we were unhoused for about 2 months. Mm-hmm. But we're definitely the lucky ones in this situation. There are still people who are moving from hotel to hotel. Mm-hmm. And I think that needs to be acknowledged that as horrible as it was for us, we are the lucky ones.
Yeah. Sounds like. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. Let's start with a couple of figures.
Okay.
So over the course of 24 days, mm-hmm. around 10,000 houses were destroyed in Altadena area mm-hmm. and a few miles down in the Pacific Palisades and other 7,000 houses I read. So this number and the devastation behind it, it's almost unimaginable.
Yeah.
And it shows how helpless we are when nature strikes mm-hmm. back, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, I mean, I was mentioning here 24 days, but you mm-hmm. said like most of Altadena was mm-hmm. destroyed in like a couple of hours.
Yeah. The fire started at 6:23 p.m. on the 7th, and my parents' house burned the next morning. Ours burned that night. And by the next morning, it was starting to die down. The wind was starting to die down. But certainly within, let's say, 18 hours, I would say pretty much all of those homes were lost. So the 10,000 number in Altadena. And then I'm not sure about how long the Palisades fire lasted,
mm-hmm.
but then each individual home burned for days. Ours burned for about a week because they had gas line breaks as well. So the gas line kept the fire going for days and they weren't able to get any of the fires out.
Okay.
So that compounded the issue.
Okay. So. And they couldn't like stop the gas from mm-hmm. flowing.
Yes.
Okay.
For us, I think it took them about a week to get the gas turned off.
Okay.
So we had a huge blaze for about a week after the fire.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that sounds so awful. So these two regions, Altadena and Pacific Palisades, were most affected by the fires, but they are we talk about this in a second, but there is quite a distance between these two locations. So everything in between was not that much affected?
Well, there were actually many other fires in that period of time. When we evacuated, to San Marino, which is just down the hill. And we were staying in the Langham Hotel and with our dogs and our cat. And we were offered by some friends to take care of a cat and take care of the dogs at two separate homes. And when we were trying to drive to one of the homes, they got evacuated. We were trying to then drive to another home to drop off the cat and they got evacuated. So the fires in that sort of week-long period were everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that were truly devastating to the communities were Altadena and the Palisades. Parts of Pasadena, parts of Malibu, I think parts of Santa Monica as well, were at least evacuated. I don't know if they lost any homes there. But those two areas were the most devastated, but the fires were everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let us talk a bit about the topography of the region here, mm-hmm. Greater Los Angeles. So LA County, I had to look that up, of course. LA mm-hmm. County includes 88 cities and communities and is home to around 10 million people.
Yes.
So it's a huge, huge, mm-hmm. huge area.
Yeah.
Pacific Palisades is located right to the coast
mm-hmm.
or the coastline. And we could see houses that were burning that mm-hmm. were like sitting directly on the ocean,
on
which
the
is
beach.
Like, how is that even possible?
Yeah.
Having houses burned down where there's basically nothing but water around you.
Yeah.
So it was really amazing to see. And Altadena, however, is around 20 miles or an optimistic calculation, 30-minute drive up to the mountain.
Not anymore. When I was a kid, maybe.
Yeah, so it's quite a distance. Uh-huh. So Altadena is snuck to the mountains of San Gabriel, mm-hmm. San Gabriel Mountains, yes. as they are called, uh-huh. right? And it's pretty high mountains. Mm-hmm. And behind these mountains lies the Mojave Desert. Mm-hmm. Mojave Desert. And if you cross the desert, you basically end up in Las Vegas.
Absolutely.
So very, very broad perspectives. That's where we are. That's where we are located. So, you said that your family has mm-hmm. been in the area for quite a few generations.
Yeah.
So what brought your family to Altadena?
Actually, the aerospace industry. Both of my grandfathers were engineers. Both of them were aerospace engineers, and both of them ended up in a place called El Segundo, which is actually not too far from the Palisades, on the coast. And that's where my parents met. That's where they grew up. And, when they got married, they ended up moving up here because my dad went to college in the area and fell in love with Altadena. It's this beautiful little enclave right next to the mountains. It's, able to take advantage of all the wonderful opportunities in Los Angeles and Pasadena with the theater and the beach and the, you know, and all of Hollywood and all of that kind of thing. But it feels very secluded and it is a small town feel. So having grown up in Altadena, I knew everybody. When we're walking the dogs, it should have taken 45 minutes to do the walk. And instead it would take 3 hours because people would just come out of their homes as they see you walking by. And I've known them my whole life. And the little street where my parents lived, all of the homes were burned. And I think that the last person who moved in there 40 years ago. So these are truly our family members. And this is a truly small town community. Even though it is right here on the edge of Los mm-hmm, Angeles, mm-hmm. my husband would go to the hardware store practically every day, and everyone knows his name. They know his frequent shopper number by heart, so he never had to, to get it out. And everyone knows you in the post office and in, the stores and everything. So that's Altadena. It was a very unique and special place. And that's why I decided when I had my own child to move back. So
to come back here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I also read that, like you said, like Beverly Hills is around the corner. Malibu is around the mm-hmm. corner. Like these mm-hmm. would be the places that we as Germans know as this glittery Los Angeles yeah. filming industry yeah. area. And, mm-hmm. and, when I was researching for this podcast, I read that Altadena was so much different. It was, yeah. it drew like artists
yes.
and creative people mm-hmm. and all these people, they all met here in Altadena,
absolutely.
Basically, right?
So it has a fabulous
rich
history.
Cultural history and
yeah.
Yeah. And now the face of the city will probably change a bit. Yeah.
It will. And it's very sad because a lot of the cultural history has been erased. I think that the cultural history for the African American community was particularly important. It was one of the first places in the area, I think in all of Southern California, where African Americans could buy homes. Mm-hmm. So there was something called redlining, where they would actually draw lines on a map and say African Americans could only buy properties in this area. And it was one of the very first areas that African Americans could buy. So there was a lot of generational wealth, and that because of the generational wealth, it created a really wonderful opportunity for people, musicians, painters, writers. And so we have a huge, long history of African-American culture developing in Altadena. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the most tragic losses is that all of that is gone. Mm-hmm. A lot of the African-American community aren't going to be able to stay in their homes. The art itself was lost and the tradition has been lost and people are scattering. So I think that acknowledging that is an incredibly important thing. We've lost a really special place.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
And a place that was not known to many people other than mm-hmm. the places mentioned before. So
for good reason. We liked it the way it was.
Secluded was the word that
yes.
you were using.
Yeah. It was like a whole bunch of
little
hikers island. And hippies and artists.
Yeah.
yeah.
And you guys in between. Yeah.
Yes.
So looking back at the development of the fire.
Yeah.
the region, I learned, is used to having fires. Mm-hmm. So the mountains mm-hmm. and the location play an essential role, right, mm-hmm. with the winds and everything. Yeah. So can you explain a bit how fires can spread so easily here?
Well, unfortunately, they've gotten more and more prevalent over the years. So when I was a kid, we would occasionally have a fire maybe every 15, 20 years. And now it's becoming a yearly thing. I think that no one can argue that global warming and global climate change is yeah. real, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, our mountains have gotten drier and drier. And we used to have snow in the mountains. We used to actually have a ski place right up here. I grew up skiing in these mountains.
In
right?
these incredible
Absolutely.
Mountains.
So it was when I was a kid, it was a half an hour to the beach and a half an hour to the skiing, right? And I could easily play a softball game in the morning, go skiing in the afternoon, or go to the beach in the morning, go skiing in the afternoon. You know, and that was not unusual. It was something we did regularly. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that ski resort hasn't opened in about 20 years. And we no longer get snow. And now we're starting to no longer get rain. Mm-hmm. And so what we call the fire season used to just be October, maybe a little bit of September. Mm-hmm. And now the fire season is getting to be year long.
Year-round, right?
Yeah. So, and every time there's a fire, the mountains aren't able to recover all of their growth before there's the next fire. Mm. So we're getting less and less growth in the mountains. The animals are obviously being more and more stressed. And there's no time to recover before the next fire season because it's becoming year-round, whereas maybe it was a month when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So what happened this year that made this so incredibly different is we get these intense winds in the area. Usually we get a windstorm when I was a kid, maybe every few years. And now the wind patterns are changing as well. So the winds are becoming more intense and more hurricane-like rather than just
winds.
And now that it's getting drier and drier and drier, all of the growth in the mountains is gone and we're no longer getting snow and now we're no longer getting rain. Mm-hmm. It has changed the situation.
Yeah, I can imagine if there can no natural protection grow in the mountains
yeah.
that could, you know,
yeah.
reduce the speed of the wind.
Exactly.
Of course.
I remember wearing winter coats and having snow in this area when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And now, this January, right before the fire started, I took a picture of the temperature gauge and it was over 100 degrees in January.
Mm-hmm. And that was not.
And that is not the way it's been in the past. So because there was no rain last fall at all, not a single drop.
Yeah.
The winds started before the rains. And so all of a sudden you have intense dry tinder in the mountains. And then the winds caused the fire. The winds were a part of the cause of the fire. And then when the fire started, it spread like a hurricane. So to call it a firestorm is truly correct. It was a 90 mile per hour wall of fire coming mm-hmm. at us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we saw some of the footage on social media or on TV. So it was pretty big on all channels everywhere. But I think nobody can imagine this because this somehow doesn't fit to this area here that a hurricane can develop and can take up the speed as mm-hmm. it had. And of course, leaving nothing, leaving nothing on the way once it blazes through, right?
Yeah. And I think that the United States is seeing a change in weather patterns everywhere. One of my best friends lives in the Philadelphia area, and they actually had a hurricane in Philadelphia. They've never had one before. Mm-hmm. They also had a hurricane that reached as far north as New York City. So these are things that have never happened before. So for us to have hurricane-type winds with the dry weather, I mean, it was just a perfect storm. It really was a perfect storm to completely destroy large swaths of Los Angeles.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hurricanes, I would connect to the Florida area in my mm-hmm. head. Like if I hear hurricanes in USA, in my head, Florida area pops out with the sea,
absolutely.
And open sea and So these people are used to it. But yeah, climate change affects all of us. So the winds themselves cannot not cause the fire. You told me that this could be narrowed down to one single source.
Yes. And
as an empire, right?
Absolutely. So what happened was that the electrical company had an old tower that they hadn't serviced for over 75 years. And this old tower, they just left up there. And it may or may not have been connected. We don't know yet. That it will come out as things develop.
Yeah.
But what they do have is they have video footage of the fact that because it hadn't been serviced, pieces of the tower were banging against each other, creating sparks.
Okay. And due to the winds. In this windy situation.
So, exactly. So you have 90-mile-per-hour winds. You have this ancient tower that hasn't been serviced. You have pieces of the tower, you know, metal pieces banging against each other, creating sparks. You have nothing but tinder all over the mountain. It hasn't rained in a year, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little less than that, 8 months, maybe. And you, all of a sudden, everything catches on fire, and it was coming at us at 90 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband, when he arrived home to try to evacuate, and I know we'll get to this, but he, with his Air Force training, he was able to identify that it was coming at down our street at least 50 miles an hour, just based upon his
knowledge
of distances and how fast it was going.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, who would know? I mean, who has this knowledge and who has this background information? So, talking about January 7th, all these dry months.
Yes.
This day came. Mm-hmm. I remember my daughter saying, hey, it's never raining there. So, for her perspective, of course, this was great being German, right? It's always sunny days. Uh-huh. So, yeah, but of course, you could tell, like, this cannot be good.
Not good.
But of course, nobody could see what was about to happen. So you work as an emergency doctor.
Yes.
So this day you set off for work and everything seemed to be normal.
Yeah.
It was the days for our daughters to go back to school. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah.
Because we set off our daughter and we had to stop her from flying back because there were all these warnings coming. Mm-hmm. So how did that day start for you, basically? It was a normal work day, right?
It was a normal work day.
To anticipate what happened.
I did have a little bit of a spidey sense. I know that sounds silly, but, I woke up. My husband and I took the dogs around the block, did our normal morning dog walk with them. And there was something in the air that felt different. And I even said to my husband that morning, gosh, I feel like something's different in the area. He said, well, we are supposed to get a windstorm later today. Mm-hmm. He said, I wonder if I should stay home and evacuate the house. Mm-hmm. He goes, well, you could. It is awfully dry and we are supposed to get a windstorm. I said, gosh, I'd hate to do that to my colleagues. Just call off for no reason.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not sick.
Yeah.
There's nothing going on. But I just had this, you know, spidey sense.
This voice in your head.
This voice in my head. I wish I'd listened to. And went home, had some breakfast. He waved from the front porch like he always does. I drove out of the driveway, drove to work. And then at 7 p.m. that night, so I'd already been at work for 7 hours. I started my shift at noon. I was in the middle of seeing a patient, talking to a patient, interviewing them, and I started getting, I carry multiple phones on me when I'm at work.
Mm-hmm.
And I started getting back-to-back text messages. So I excused myself from the room because the only time that happens, nobody ever contacts me at work.
Mm-hmm.
The only time that happens is if there's an emergency. So I step out of the room. I look down. I'm getting back-to-back text messages. A friend of mine had sent me a text of the end of her street on fire and saying, I hear that she lives in Pasadena. And she said, I hear that it's also raging through Altadena. And then my dad moments later sent a text message of the mountains right behind the house on fire. So I did something that ER doctors never do, which is that I left a shift in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
I very quickly signed out my patients. I got these text messages at 6:55. The fire started at 6:23.
Mm-hmm.
So we're already looking at 40 minutes-ish into the fire by the time I even found out. And I signed out and started driving home.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine. I mean, working in emergency, you do not easily say, okay, because, I mean, you all have your roles and your duties there. And that must have been a big decision to take. So you could make the decision to drive back.
Mm-hmm.
So did you already have in your mind, like, I need to pack up and this is what I need to take?
Mm-hmm.
Or is that like autopilot? Or do you have a plan on these evacuations?
Yeah.
Because we said earlier that mm-hmm. basically you are used to fires. So basically you are used to the idea and the plan. Okay, I need to get out quickly. And this is the list that I need to check off. This is what I need to take.
Yeah. Well, we do. We have an evacuation
do, right?
list. My parents also had an evacuation list. Unfortunately, the situation was different than any other evacuation we've ever been through.
Mm-hmm.
Always before the fire has started in the mountains, and then always sweeps across the mountains, maybe a few houses at the edge of the mountains are burned.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, those houses don't get rebuilt. Or maybe sometimes they do, but oftentimes they don't get rebuilt because we're trying to move people away from the mountains.
From the mountains,
right?
Yeah.
But never has it come into the neighborhoods like it has before. So we've evacuated before. We've thought about it before. My parents actually had a written out list that they couldn't get to because it was on the computer. And the electricity had been out all day. And so the situation was quite different than it ever had been before.
I can
Always
imagine.
Before, yeah. The fire had been burning for hours. I make it home. I'm able to pack up multiple cars, get all of the family heirlooms, and then go to safety. This was different. By the time I got in the car, the fire had already been raging and had burning homes for 40 minutes. I drove back through 90 mile per hour winds, and that was different. There was a full tree, 40 foot full tree, blowing down the freeway at me on its side. So I had to pull my car all the way over to the side of the freeway, let the tree roll by me.
Oh my God.
And
the
then
freeway.
So
freeway is like the Autobahn. Like it's
it's the Autobahn.
Huge,
absolutely.
It has multiple lanes. And,
So this is a five.
Not a small road. It's like.
It's a five lane, six lane freeway with a huge tree rolling down. So now if we're talking about sort of segment intending action, you know, I'm an ER doctor. You learn to triage. That's part of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
You have your ABCs. You have your 1-2-3s. You get through step one before moving on to step two. So yes, in the back of my head, it's what can I save from my house? But step one is I have to get there to evacuate. I can't get in touch with my husband. All the cell phone service is down. I can't get in touch with my
Oh, that
my
was
parents.
Also down by that time. Oh, my God. Electricity,
so there's no electricity,
mobile phones.
Mobile phones. So I don't know where my husband is. I don't know. I'm pretty sure my parents are at home, but I don't know if he's at home or if he's out with a client. I'm not sure. So I have to try to get home first, get up to the house to try to get the pets, get our two dogs and our cat. And that is step one. So for triaging, you know, you go into fight or flight and you go step by step. So the first step is getting home, and those 90 mile per hour winds and that tree rolling down the freeway at me was almost took me out. Then trying to get the 3 miles from the freeway home was crazy. There were trees falling left and right. And we're the trees in this area are huge.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about 100 foot, you know, multiple hundreds of year old trees that are massive.
Yeah. And the palm trees. I mean,
the palm trees
would easily cover the road because
easily.
Fall. Yeah.
Palm trees don't tend to fall over. I'm talking about the pine trees, the deodar cedars. These will take out, you know, houses when they fall. Certainly they take out cars. And trying to get from the freeway up to the house was insane. There was no light. There were no stop signs. There were no stop lights. People were driving erratically, swerving all over the road, trying to avoid other cars, trying to avoid trees falling into the road. And there would be huge branches on fire, just absolutely coming out of nowhere at your car. The only light was the light of the mountain because it was on fire and the flames. I've never seen the flames like that.
So it was day, but it was basically dark.
Right? It was nighttime by now.
It was nighttime by then. Yeah.
Because this was January. So.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So it was definitely nighttime by then. So I left the hospital at 7. I probably made it home by 8:30. By the time I got home, my husband was there. And he had gotten two dogs into the car. He had spent 30 minutes, 45 minutes, something like that, finding the cat.
I can imagine. Yeah. She was outside.
No, she was inside, is running around a pitch black house with, his cell phone in his mouth, as the only light, trying to catch her. And then the evacuations.
She didn't want to get caught.
Yeah. She didn't want to get caught. Yeah. And then the evacuations warnings start out of the cell phone. So we did get evacuation warnings. And we didn't get them until the end of the street. Street was on fire. But, you know, so you've had this loud, blaring sound going as he's chasing her with a flashlight. So it took him 30, 45 minutes, something like that, to get her into her cat carrier, get her into the car. And by then, he was shaking so hard, he couldn't get our safe open, which is where all of our vital documents are. So it took four large men to carry the safe up the stairs and then bolt it into the floor. My husband pulled it out. You know, talk about the Hulk, right? He pulled it out and walked it down the stairs. He says he wishes that he had just thrown it down the stairs, but at the time he wasn't convinced our house was going to burn down. So he walked it down the stairs and threw it into the front seat of the car. So when I arrived home, he had two dogs and a cat and a safe. And was just shaking, and he knocked out his tooth in the process, and so he's bleeding from his mouth. So that's what I arrived home to, and the whole end of the street's on fire.
Yeah, yeah.
But
it's unimaginable how much strength you can develop. I mean, steel safe.
Absolutely.
Oh my God, the image that I have in my head now is like.
And you've met my husband. Yeah. He's very strong, but he's a normal size guy.
Yeah, but then when time is running against you, you can do incredible things.
Incredible things, yeah.
Yeah, but still, you could manage to evacuate the most important, the most precious, like your animals and yourself and everyone. But there was a lot that you needed to leave behind, right?
Unfortunately, yes. We ran through the house. Most of what we got was my daughter's stuffed animals. You know, we were standing in our room looking around saying, if our house burns down, what is going to make her feel like a new place is home? So I spent most of our evacuation time going through her stuffed animal closet.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I couldn't find her number one favorite stuffed animal from childhood. But at one point, my husband grabbed my hand, pulled me out of the closet, and was like, "We have got to go." So I just ran through every other room and grabbed tiny little things that I could find to take with us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
While I was in the stuffed animal closet, he was able to run around and grab a few things that were important to him. A few items that his mom made. She passed away a number of years ago. A few items that had special significance for him. And we got all that in the car. And then I started to go up into the attic because that's where all of our family heirlooms are. You know, my grandmother was a founding member of the Women's Army Corps. And so we had her uniform and we had her teacup collection and we had, you know, family silver that had been passed through the generations and daguerreotypes, which are an old type of photography, one of the very first types of photography. Mm-hmm. And we had tons of daguerreotypes from the Civil War of family members. And, you know, all of them were labeled in my grandmother's handwriting as who they were, what the date of the photo was, how they were related to us. And I think that as much as it's horrifying that we lost this beautiful 100-year-old home and all of our amazing furniture, we had furniture from 1623, you know, hand-carved, you know, English coffers, amazing things. But the family heirlooms are the things that are most horrifying. We had all of my great-grandmother's journals. Mm. So my great-grandmother was born in the mid-1800s, and we had all of her journals from growing up and watching the world change.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were things that just cannot be replaced.
Yes. And this is probably not the first thing that's on your mind when you're like, okay, what are now the 50 things I can fit in my car?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, there's probably documents and, like you said, things for your daughter and like the most important things to prioritize. So, and
none of that stuff. And I'm an only grandchild.
Yeah.
On both sides. So I don't have any cousins. And I don't, I'm the end of the gene pool.
Okay.
So all of the family heirlooms have come to me. Yeah. Everything. Mm-hmm. And anything that I didn't have possession of was in my parents' house.
So you evacuated your place and then you went to your parents' house?
Yeah. So the end
because
of
you couldn't communicate.
Couldn't communicate. So the end of our street, the fire was coming really fast, and in a you can't tell exactly in a fire how where it is, because as I said, there's embers and sparks flying through the air, and they're swirling around you. Mm. So your clothes are getting burned, your hat is getting burned as you're
trying to. The air must be horrible.
And, so by the time we could see houses burning on our street by the time we left, and my husband grabbed my hand. He was like, "You cannot go into the attic. It's pitch black." Mm-hmm. And we've got to leave this stuff behind. If we don't leave now, we're probably going to die. And if you fall or fall down the attic stairs, you know, there's no way that this is going to go well, right? We've got to leave this stuff behind and go.
It was probably a good decision.
It was a good decision. It was a decision choosing life rather than choosing stuff. And even though the stuff is more than just stuff, it's family heirlooms, it's our tangible past, it's our history, it's generations. And I mean, there was a family Bible that was started in 1830, and every birth and every death has been
documented
in this. Yeah. And the hide was buffalo hide that one of my great, 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 great grandfathers killed the buffalo as they were coming across in a, you know, the United States in a covered wagon. And we had the horns and we had the buffalo hide covering the Bible. And we had every person in our family, every Armstrong since 1830 has been labeled. And my husband and I got married with our hands on that Bible. So there were things that can never, ever, ever be replaced. Mm-hmm. But what we did was we chose life over stuff.
Yeah, you chose down life.
To the elderly cat who took 30 minutes to get out of the house.
But I totally understand. I mean, that's what you do. That's what you prioritize. And this is probably what you said in your triage thinking. Okay, what is the priority of things that keep me going and that I can start new with? But of course, it's a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous loss.
Yeah.
And your parents, could they? They did the same thing in parallel. They packed their top 10 of things, right?
Yeah. So what happened with my parents was that I couldn't get in touch with them other than that text message I got before the cell service went down. My parents have never been considered a burn zone or a high-risk fire area or anything like that. So I was pretty sure that they were collecting stuff for evacuation, but I wanted to make sure now that I saw the fire, how fast it was coming, I saw what was going on. I wanted to make sure that they actually left the house because people in their neighborhood tend to stay put until they're told because it's never been a fire zone before. So as my husband and I were driving down the road, I said, you know, I haven't been able to get in touch with them to make sure that they're not, that they're still at home. We've got to make sure they've actually left the house. So he continued on towards our evacuation point, and I was just going to drive around the cul-de-sac and make sure both of their cars were gone. And both of their cars were there. So I stopped, I ran inside, and my dad had gotten out of the hospital the day before.
Okay.
So he had been collecting stuff, putting it in the front hallway, but he was breathing heavily. He was having difficulty breathing. My mom was trying to find the car keys, which normally she could place her hands on in a second. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's pitch black. The only light is the light of their cell phones and the light of the fire, the orange light coming in through the window. I will never like the color orange again, by the way.
Can you imagine? Yeah.
And so as she's looking for the keys, because now the fire is visible, the flames, the shooting flames are visible from their house. As I said, they've never been considered a burn zone in the past. So I was going to dump everything out of my car and just put my parents and their dog in my car. My mom was like, I can find the keys. We've got a few minutes. We've got some time because I can see the flames, but the house next door is not on fire yet. I'm like, are we really going to wait that long?
Very optimistic.
This is coming at 90 miles. My husband was saying anywhere above 50 miles per hour. And now, yeah. In retrospect, they thought the winds were about 90 miles per hour that night. So she and my dad were looking for the keys, and I was just throwing anything. I was grabbing stuff off their walls. Unfortunately, I didn't know where the family Bible and the family silver were kept because I went to where they used to be when I lived there, 30 years ago, but they were no longer in the same location. So I did have the presence of mind to try to go after heirlooms while I was at their house, but things, I haven't lived in my parents' home for many years, so I didn't know where everything was.
That's, of course, not the first thing that you talk about when you visit your parents.
Yeah, it should be, but it's not.
Of course it's not. It's other things. Yeah.
So we never, and we also never really thought that their house would burn down. Mm. I think that because they'd never actually even been evacuated before, my parents.
Okay.
We had prepared for evacuation and we'd pulled all the heirlooms into the front hallway many, many times, but had never actually been evacuated.
Mm-hmm.
But this, as I said, this was a different fire.
Yeah, but then you cannot really prepare. Then it's like, okay, the situation is like we've known it before.
Mm-hmm.
It's serious, but maybe not that serious.
Yeah.
So, of course. Yeah.
This was different.
So you all got out and did you know where to go? Like, is there plans on like, okay, you drive this road and this is where you all gather?
Yeah.
Or
so
a plan for that? A recommendation? Or was there like the firefighters outside telling you what to do? Or
there were no firefighters. And I think that this is something that is still a point of anger and hostility and resentment from the community here in Altadena. All of our and I can't blame the firefighters necessarily. It's not, they are on the front lines. As a frontline worker myself, I understand that there are times when you cannot perform your job because there's not enough people.
Mm-hmm.
There's not the right circumstances. But apparently all of our fire trucks had gone to the Palisades because they started burning 10 hours earlier than we did. There was apparently only one fire truck in the entire area. And that one fire truck cannot handle hurricane.
Yep. Not at all.
Hurricane firestorms.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So there was nobody.
They couldn't bring them back quick enough and they were burning in parallel, right?
Well, exactly. And apparently, this is horrible. Apparently, there are stories about firefighters who lived in Altadena who were fighting the Palisades fires, and they don't keep their phones on them. And their wives, they get calls from their wives saying, okay, a fire started in Eaton Canyon. Okay, I think we're going to have to evacuate. Okay, I've got, the kids and the dogs in the car. You got to get home. Can you get home? Oh, my gosh, our house is burning down. And they get this series of calls while they are fighting a different fire across Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So yes, of course, I don't blame our firefighters because they were doing the right thing, but that fire started first. So they were fighting a different firestorm when ours started. But there was only one truck in the entirety of Altadena that night. And nobody came. There were no sirens. The sirens were only on our phones. My husband holding this phone in his mouth, trying to find the cat. Those were the only sirens. Those were the only evacuation. We in East Altadena got evacuation warnings. West Altadena, the reason so many people died is because they burned in their beds, not having gotten evacuation warnings.
They didn't even get warnings.
Exactly. And there's
That's awful. Yeah.
A lot of people who have a lot of strong words about that. And we don't need to the African American community in Altadena lives. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of talk about why they did not get any evacuation warning.
Yeah. So, which is understandable completely, of course.
So when I arrived at my parents' house and I helped them load their cars, we found their keys, thankfully. And then I had already set a plan with my husband. And at that point, my parents followed us to a friend's house in San Marino.
Okay. Okay, so they still could drive and it could get out.
Yeah.
So when did you find out that both of your houses didn't make it?
Well, we didn't sleep that night. We were, my friend gave her bed to my mom and dad. And my husband and I were on the floor in her living room and managing all of the pets. And unfortunately, my mom and dad's dog doesn't get along with our cat. So there was a lot of conflict between them that night. We didn't sleep. We didn't sleep. We watched, there's a fire watch app, and we watched the fire spread across Altadena on the app. Our house, we think, burned down around 10:30 p.m. Mm-hmm. We didn't even get to my friend's house until about 10:30. And so, because it took, it was so hard to get out of Altadena. You drive down a road and there's a tree down, you know, there's flame, things bursting in flames in front of you. So you have to backtrack and go a different direction. My husband's car almost got completely crushed by a giant pine tree that fell. And the pine tree fell immediately behind his car, and then everybody on the road behind him got caught.
Yeah.
And he said he saw big trucks trying to drive over the tree or around the tree, but all of the smaller cars, people were just getting out with their dogs and just running.
We saw that footage.
Yeah.
I saw that on Instagram. We saw that, and that, like, later on they sent in bulldozers to, like, move
cars.
The cars out of the way so that people could get
back to their properties. Yeah. So we were all incredibly lucky that we got out to our friend's house in San Marino, and then we watched the app all night long. And then at about, the winds died down maybe 4 a.m. They were still going, but they weren't the 90 mile per hour hurricane type
strong
winds
anymore. Mm-hmm.
So at that point, my husband got in the car, and he probably got up there around 5 o'clock in the morning. It was really hard for him to get up to find a road that wasn't blocked. And he could see that our house, we have a long 100-foot driveway, and he could see just flames billowing from the place that used to be our home. And then he tried to drive down my mom and dad's street, and everything on the street was on fire. Mm. So he came home and told me, or came back to my friend's house and told us. And I didn't have a lot of emotion. I was just numb.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on the computer and I started trying to find us a place to live.
Yeah, this is the other autopilot thing that you do, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God, this is so horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Horrible find out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think at that point, we still had some hope for my parents' house, because he couldn't get down their street. He could see that the whole end of the street was on fire. We were holding out hope that my parents' house, which was farther down this way.
Mm-hmm.
And actually at about 7 a.m., 8 a.m., something like that, we got a text message from a friend who had been able to get onto their street, who videoed his own house on fire and then videoed that my parents' house was still intact. At that point, there were about 20, 25 neighbors who'd made it back up the mountain to that street, trying to fight the fire coming down. They made a daisy chain across Holliston, which is the main road, and they stopped the one fire truck that any of us saw that entire experience. And they said, the end of this street is on fire. If you can just put out the end of the street, then this whole enclave of 30 homes will be saved. And the firefighters said no, and they kept going.
Okay.
So, you know, this is a chain of people across a road, and they said no. Now, again, I don't want to blame them. As a frontline worker, I understand that there are things out of our control. And we have found out after the fact that all of the fire hydrants had run out of water. So it's very possible that they didn't have any water to work with, and they just didn't tell that to the neighbors. But people are pretty angry because there's one fire truck.
Yeah.
And they could have saved all of these homes by just putting out those three that were at the end of the street. Just put out those three and all of these homes would have been saved. So our neighbors had buckets and they were using pool water and passing buckets down a chain of 25 people to try to keep my parents' house from catching fire. And obviously they couldn't. And my parents' home caught fire sometime that morning and was gone.
So it was safe through the night, but caught fire in the morning and could not be saved.
Could not be saved. And if that fire truck had stopped, maybe they could have at least used their hoses out of all. I mean, everybody has a pool, you know, use their hoses to hose down the fires. I don't know that that would have worked, but it's better than buckets.
Yeah. Faster. You know?
It's faster than buckets. And if the hydrants were truly out, then there's probably not much they could have done. But people are very angry and very hostile about the fact that we had no fire and no police presence at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's again, understandable.
Yeah.
They probably followed orders.
Yeah.
And, this fact, I think, was communicated that the area ran out of water.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I think that people would be less hostile if they had just said, I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
But there's no water in the hydrants.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't do that to prevent people from.
Yeah. Exactly.
But
instead, those homes are now gone. You know, and these are my family members. These are the people I grew up with. I've known them for almost 50 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And
but like you say, you have more understanding of the situation
being
a doctor and working in front line. I mean, these were probably, don't know anything, but these were probably difficult decisions to take also.
Absolutely.
On their side. And
And that was the only single fire truck anyone saw in that whole period of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, it's really unbelievably sad, and this affected then so many families, so many lives, so many generations.
And people literally burned in their homes. Mm-hmm. You know, there are just so many stories.
Yeah.
My neighbor's gardener, for example. So Altadena is an area where one part of Altadena is very, very wealthy and the other part of Altadena is more sort of middle class. And then there are areas that are a little bit depressed socioeconomically. So we have a very wide range. This is part of why people love living here, because there's a wide range of socioeconomic status, every kind of cultural and ethnic group that you can think of. We love this about Altadena.
It makes it very rich. Right?
It's a very rich community. Yeah. It was a very rich community. So my neighbors who have a $7 million home, you know, they live on a huge piece of property in the very wealthy area of Altadena, and their gardener lives in the not as wealthy area of Altadena and would walk to work every day. And he's their groundskeeper. And so he was there every single day. And so we got to know him over the years. And he apparently woke up at about 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, and the entire room was on fire around him. And the only reason he woke up is because it got hot and he was starting to have trouble breathing. And so he ran out of his house in his underwear and lost everything except for his underwear.
Oh, my God.
And he had to.
No time.
And he walked to the Pasadena Convention Center and lived there for months.
Mm-hmm.
And then was able to reconnect with our neighbors and, you know, his employers. And thankfully, he lived through the experience. But this. This is what happened to a lot of people, and he was able to get out, but a lot of people burned in their beds.
How many victims were that?
I don't know the actual numbers, and we can look up the numbers that are published, but the numbers that are published don't take into account undocumented people.
Oh, there are.
And there's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of undocumented people who died that were not counted, and there are a lot of people who weren't counted who were like, for example, elderly people with COPD who ended up in the hospital, you know, people who had heart attacks that night. None of those are counted in the numbers.
Okay.
We've had two neighbors die since.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to safely evacuate, but they passed away.
They didn't make it through the following months.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Because given the number of houses that were burned down, the number of victims who didn't make it, looks like, if you only look at the numbers, look fairly small.
Yeah.
But if you say not everybody was documented, counted, of course.
Exactly. Not everyone's counted, and not everyone who, and the only people who were counted are the bodies that are found. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily the people who died in the hospital.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Also an interesting development, right?
Yeah.
So when, I mean, could you, I saw this, that people were returning to what was left from their places, what was left from their houses, what was left from the areas. When you went back, did you find anything of value or anything of what meant something to you in ashes, in rubble, in...
Yeah, actually, you I did.
What was that?
I spent about... Well, first of all, it was about a month before we could make it back to our...
Because the place was burning for that long, right? Yeah.
It was burning for about a week, and then the National Guard came in and shut down all of Altadena. They shut down all of the Pacific Palisades because there were so many looters, and there was so much... It was chaos. It was Armageddon. It really was. And so there were looters. There was chaos. There was violence in the streets. And so they shut everything down. And I think it was about a month before we were even allowed to go look to see what was left. So my husband went up first, and I really should let him tell you this story, but he's not here. So I'll tell you the story. So the first time he went up, we were understanding the fact that you had to wear masks. You had to wear a Tyvek suit because of the toxicity. And so he was wearing a mask, but he wasn't wearing a suit because he had no intention of going through the rubble or the ashes. His intention was just to see what it looked like to prepare me to bring me back up with him. So, because frankly, I kind of lost my nerve the morning we were supposed to go up and I couldn't do it. So he went by himself. So the first thing he did was walk up our brick steps, which were still there. Brick steps and a chimney, a brick wall, and everything else is gone. And he started just walking around the exterior of where the house had been. And he gets over to the area where our china cabinet was. And he looks down, and emerging out of the ashes is our wedding cup. And it's the cup that we got married with. So it's called a wedding cup, and my parents brought it to us from Mexico. And it's just beautiful handmade object that we used in this ceremony. You know, the bride drinks out of one side and the groom drinks out of the other. And it was perfect. It's as if... nothing had happened. It wasn't even charred.
It was supposed to get back to you.
Exactly. Yeah. It was supposed to get back to us. And that was the very first object that was found. And, you know, I think that obviously the significance and the meaning behind that is pretty apparent, that our home is where our family is. Our home is where the people are, the life is. And all of this stuff, even the stuff that's of incredible, immense value, like our heirlooms, it's still stuff. And that was a reminder that the very first thing that he found was from our wedding, and it was our wedding cup, the one we actually used in our ceremony. So over the course of the next few months after that, I guess about 2 months actually after that, I spent hundreds of hours in a Tyvek suit and a big giant mask in the ashes. I would spend sometimes 10 or 12 hours in a day going through the ashes. And I found a lot. I can show you some of the stuff if you want.
Yeah, later.
Okay.
Unbelievable.
I did. I found a lot of things. You know, obviously things like the family Bible didn't survive, but little trinkets, some of the crafts that my daughter made growing up, you know, her little pinch pots and things like that. So, there were things that survived.
So everything has a value then, or it gets a different value if you
It has them, such right? intense value. My husband mother collected these tiny little pigs, and so we had all of her little pigs, and a lot of them survived.
See?
So now we have this whole collection of tiny little pigs that my mother-in-law collected.
The survivor pigs.
Yeah, the survivor pigs, exactly. So, yeah, so those things are now our new heirlooms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, of course. Yeah. This is how you restart them.
Yeah.
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 That they keep on telling the family story.
They do.
Then, yeah.
Yeah. And the fact that they're charred,
mm-hmm.
they've lost their color, that is part of the family story.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So how did your parents handle the news that there is no home to return to after 50 years?
Yeah. I think that my parents are incredibly strong, incredibly resilient people. So I think they did really well with it. I think that there was, of course, shock. There was freeze, just like all of us.
Mm-hmm.
I, as an ER doctor, I tend to go into action.
Mm-hmm.
But most people freeze in a moment of
for a longer
trauma.
Time, probably. Yeah. Yeah.
So there was some freeze, but it didn't last very long. I think my dad jumped into action the next day and started working through things, getting a post office box, forwarding our mail, things that were very, very tangible things that had to be put on a list and then you could check it off. And mm-hmm. I think that in a moment of trauma like this, that's so important. You say, okay, how am I going to move forward? What am I going to do? Let's make a list. Let's check things off of the list when they're done. That gives you a sense of accomplishment. It gives you a sense that you are somehow still at least in partial control of your life.
You're in action, right?
Yeah,
you
exactly.
can influence things and you are not just
yeah.
after everything that comes from the outside. You have yeah. to take control of things that you can have influence on, right?
Exactly.
This helps, yeah.
And we all think that we're in control of our lives, but it's an illusion.
Yeah.
None of us are.
Yeah.
And I think that the fire is a perfect example of that. I leave the house in the morning and wave to my husband as I always do. And then,
a few hours later, you never know what you come home to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you see a difference in handling ever since this incident? Do you see a difference in handling the way of continuing? Like after taking these first actions that we just talked about,
yeah.
how is the generation of your parents handling this versus your generation, your and your husband's generation?
Well, I'm not necessarily seeing a lot of generational consistency.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that for a lot of people, it all comes down to money, right? Mm-hmm. It all comes down to money. Do you have insurance? So people who have insurance have the option to rebuild or the option to buy, mm-hmm. to buy elsewhere. Excuse me. People who didn't have insurance, a lot of them are still homeless.
Yeah.
A lot of them are really, truly scraping by. When I ever get my life into control, I want to go start building homes because I think that groups like Habitat for Humanity are going to make a huge difference in the lives of the people who didn't have insurance.
What is Habitat for Humanity? What
are you doing? Habitat for Humanity builds homes all over the world for people.
Okay.
I think it's an international organization.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I have actually contributed money. My grandfather contributed a ton of money to Habitat for years and years and years. And it's just a really great organization that tries to make sure people have safe housing. So Habitat for Humanity really is, and there are lots of other organizations. I just happen to be focusing on that one. But there are lots of organizations that are going to be building homes for people who didn't have insurance. So, so the generational thing for me is less apparent than the economic part
yeah.
of it. So
I don't even want to ask this question, but if I don't, it will linger.
Yeah.
Have your places been insured?
Yes. Thankfully, we both had insurance. My husband was in the Air Force. My dad was also in the Air Force. So the two of them are both Air Force veterans. So we have USAA, which is by far the best insurance company known to the United States. So
really
we
happy.
Are. Yes.
Yeah.
So my husband and my father both served their time in the U.S. military, and as a result, our insurance is excellent.
Okay.
So we have, that being said, it's not going to cover the cost of the rebuild.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, because what it would have cost for a single home to be rebuilt after a house fire is now upwards of doubled.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have a massive community, well, two massive communities plus scattered areas all over the city that all burned down on one night. So we had about 10,000 structures in Altadena and another, I think, 6,000 structures in the Palisades, you know, and that's
seven I read. But
oh, seven. Okay. Yeah. You're probably, I haven't actually looked at the numbers.
I asked ChatGPT.
Okay. ChatGPT probably knows better than I do. So if we're talking about 17,000 structures just in those two communities, plus scattered structures all over the city, then all of a sudden the cost of building materials is going to go through the roof.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The cost of labor is going to go through the roof. The time it takes to get plans, mm-hmm. To find an architect, to find a builder, all of these things, it's going to go through the roof. Then add to that other kinds of issues that are going on in the United States right now, like tariffs. Tariffs have doubled the cost of some items.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday I was looking up the cost of the copper weather vane that we bought when we replaced our roof. So we replaced our roof in December of 2024. It was finished about 2 weeks prior to the fire. It was a $175,000 fireproof roof.
Okay.
The roof looked great.
Yeah.
The house burned under it, but the roof was still perfect.
Oh, my God.
Okay. So we had just put up this weather vane. We bought the weather vane in, you know, September or October of 2024. And I looked up the cost of it because my husband really wants another weather vane. I looked up the cost of it yesterday. The cost has doubled.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely 100% doubled. It was $125 when we bought the weather vane. It's now, you know, $250 for the same exact item.
Mm-hmm.
So the cost of every nail, every board of wood, every single item has gone up. Plus, unfortunately, with the change in our immigration policies in the United States, a huge percentage of our workforce has now been deported.
People who could help you rebuild?
Yes, they're gone.
They're just not there anymore.
They're gone. Yeah. And I don't want to get political on your podcast, so I will not give my opinion about any of these things.
Yeah, but it would have helped. I mean,
what I will say is that our world has changed since the fire.
Yeah.
And the cost of things has doubled. Add to that the labor issues. Add to that the fact that it was 17,000 structures in one night. And so even people who have excellent insurance where it would have covered the cost of our rebuild prior to the fire, the day after the fire with these particular, again, another perfect storm, these particular circumstances, and it's not going to cover it. So we're going to do our best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you would plan on rebuilding?
Yes,
you
we are.
Leave the property and
mm-hmm.
because mm-hmm. I do not think many or there are people who cannot do it, you said.
Yeah.
When we were talking first, like the face of Altadena, the face of the whole area will change because, like you said, many people first, probably or possibly did not have insurance or not mm-hmm. enough insurance to get them anywhere.
Yeah.
Or they can simply not afford to rebuild, right?
Absolutely.
So the face of the area will change.
It will absolutely change. I think East Altadena will probably look generally the way it did before the fire
mm-hmm.
because that's where people who had insurance, that most of those homes had insurance. You know, they were multi-million-dollar homes and no one can afford a multi-million-dollar mortgage. So if you've got a mortgage, you're required to have insurance. So those places, I would say, probably without fail, were all insured.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the generational homes that were uninsured. Because if you pass a home through generations and the mortgage has been paid off over many, many years,
it's an issue of generations, of course.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, the cost of insurance is going sky high because it's getting drier and hotter and the risk of fire. A lot of people gave up their insurance or were canceled. In fact, one of the major insurance companies canceled pretty much, I think, 100% of their clients in Altadena on December 28th.
Mm-hmm. 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 Because this was somehow expected, right?
They didn't tell us.
No, of course. But this was the situation because it could somehow be predicted or expected that something could happen.
And exactly.
Yeah.
So a lot of those people got canceled on December 28th.
Yeah, they could not find insurance.
This was a week later.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so these are a lot of the uninsured are not necessarily people who didn't intend to have insurance or want to have insurance or hadn't been paying for insurance, but they got canceled right before the fire.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, there was too little time in between to get a new insurance to find one that takes you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you go to work in the morning, your insurance gets canceled and you think, okay, I got to get on that. But I also have to, you know, pay the bills and I have to, you know, deal with the kids and,
of course,
you know, walk the dogs. And so you don't necessarily think that it's something you have to get on the very day that it happened.
Yes.
But for people who didn't, they didn't have enough time to sign a new insurance policy before the fire hit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was the time between Christmas and New Year's. So people I would imagine, traveling, visiting family, were out of town. And this was one of the many things that you put on the list of, oh, we need to do this first thing. We are going back
into
our everyday routine.
Yeah.
Like you have millions on, I mean, we have millions of these little things that we talk about, like, hey, let's not forget, we need to do this.
So, and we know it's important. It's got to be at the top of the list.
Absolutely.
But maybe it's not happening today.
Yeah.
Well, if it didn't happen today for people, their house burned down and they didn't have any insurance.
So Los Angeles and the area here was basically in the center of international attention. So it was all over, even for us.
Mm-hmm.
But then this came to a stop, like pretty much a couple of days after. I don't know. The fires were still burning, I think.
Yeah.
But it was out of the center of attention. So I was, until now, I'm almost grateful for my my Instagram algorithm, because I was, of course, researching so much, and we had to decide whether our daughter could get back to school, could be sent back, would everything be safe. So I'm still in this algorithm, and it feeds me updates and news and, and stuff like that. So at least I can follow along a little bit. So how do you think your community, Los Angeles, Altadena, Pasadena, the local community here, how are they keeping up? Are you like, is everyone fighting his and her own fight? Or do you have the feeling that people are standing side by side and doing this together?
Well, I think that that has changed. At the beginning, there was a lot of Altadena Strong.
Yeah.
That's what we're calling it, is Altadena Strong. There was a lot of strong community and support and people really banding together. I'm afraid that that's starting to dissipate. And the community leaders who have emerged, we are actually a part of Los Angeles County unincorporated. So we're not actually our own town. We don't have a mayor. We don't have a, you know, an organized group of leadership. Unlike the Palisades, who is, they are their own town, so they've got organized leadership. We don't have organized leadership. So people
so you are
have
connected
emerged.
To Pasadena or?
No, we're unincorporated LA County.
Oh,
so
okay.
Our,
so this
our
to
only.
The county area.
Exactly. So, because we're so far out. So,
so your mayor is Los Angeles mayor?
We don't have a mayor, actually.
Okay.
We do not have a mayor because we are not a town.
The county area does not have.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have a supervisor, okay, and she's been doing her very best for us, Kathleen Barger, and but she's limited in ways that a mayor may not be limited. And her budget is for her entire fifth of LA County. It's not just for Altadena. So I think she's been doing her very best. I think that we've had a lot of sort of organic movement of people coming to the forefront as town leaders, which is great because we're not really a town. And that's all just political, is the fact that we're unincorporated and have never really come forward as a town with a mayor. And so people have been doing really well. I think that people this far out from the fire are starting to hit that midweek lull, so to speak, you know, where you don't know if you're going to be able to manage this. So we're 8 months from the fire. Most of the lots have been cleared. Our lot is not 100% cleared, which you may see later if we go up to the lot. People are starting to run into a lot of roadblocks in terms of different things that, you know, none of all of us are professionals. We're not in the building industry necessarily. Mm-hmm. So we're running into a lot of roadblocks that are difficult. So I think there's been some breakdown in the mood around here.
Yeah.
There's also been a lot of breakdown between the people who lost their homes and the people whose homes did not burn down. Mm-hmm. And so initially, the people who lost their homes were being very well supported by the people whose homes survived. And there's been some backlash. The people whose homes survived have gotten a lot of public media about how toxic their homes are. And now they're coming out saying, I wish my home had burned down. I wish I'd lost everything. And those of us who did lose everything are saying, That's don't even say that.
That's not a discussion.
Don't even say that. You know, if you've got toxicity in your home, yes, of course it needs to be dealt with, but don't start going on and on about how you wish your home had burned down. So there's been some breakdown there too. I think we're going to get through this. I think that just like Wednesday and Thursday can sometimes be the hardest days of the week.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You get through it and then you push forward and you finally reach Friday and the weekend and then you can do the following week of work. I think that will happen here too. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people are giving up right now and putting their lots on the market, but the people who are not giving up are pushing through.
Mm-hmm. So I wish for you much more Altadena strong.
Thank you. Yes.
It's important that the community stands together and
absolutely.
Yeah. That people support each other. But yeah, I can imagine. I mean, it's not a short-term engagement. It will take years and years and maybe decades.
Maybe decades.
It takes a long breath.
Yeah.
A lot of strength and a lot of empathy.
Yeah.
So I hope Altadena will stay strong.
Thank you.
So Bracken, you carry the responsibility of rebuilding two family homes. And one of the first things I read from you after the mm-hmm. fire, because my daughter forwarded this to me, was your post on the GoFundMe page that you set up.
Yeah.
And this was such a beautiful note. With a lot of...
And thank you for your donation.
Yeah, of course. But what I was going to say is this page is still open, I saw. So I will for sure put this out in my show notes.
Thank you.
So anybody hears this, they can still... it still takes donations because what you wrote there, whenever I read it, and of course I reread it a couple times when preparing this podcast, and this honestly still brings tears to my eyes to see what this put you through. So donations are still running and the link is following.
And I don't want to obviously push people away from our page, but we are the lucky ones. Mm-hmm. And I want to reiterate that there are people not as fortunate as we are. So, if people do want to donate as well, donating to a place like Habitat for Humanity and some of the other organizations that are going to be building homes for people who don't have insurance, I think that would be a very valuable thing. Now, of course, if you donate to those types of situations, you don't know that all of your money is going to the actual people. But there are some lists of GoFundMe pages that have been organized by how much money people have been able to raise. Mm-hmm. So as if you don't have as much money, your list raises to the top so that you know that the money's actually going to real human beings in Altadena who need help.
Yeah, you're welcome to give me the links.
So I can give you that list. And
Everything helps, right?
So. I do not want to send people away from my page, of course. However, we are the fortunate ones mm-hmm, here. Mm-hmm. And I do want to bring attention to the people who are less fortunate than we are. Mm-hmm, so
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really kind of you. So just give me some links and
I'll find that link.
So we were talking so much about this disaster, but it's mm-hmm. almost unbelievable. This mm-hmm. is not the first complete shutdown that you had to go through in your life. Mm-hmm. It sounds like this is not even possible, but you survived stage 4 cancer and you had a bone marrow transplant.
Yes, I did.
So, I mean, I had to look up what that is, what is behind that, but it basically means you were so sick that you were looking death right in the face.
Right in the face. Right? Yeah.
So is it okay if you share a little bit of
of course. Yeah, that was kind of my first, my first reset in my life was cancer. So I was in my medical training. So I was in residency as an emergency medicine resident at Harbor UCLA Medical Center. So it's one of the big county hospitals, as we call it, the knife and gun club. So lots of gang activity, very, very sick.
The rough
patients.
Side of LA.
It's the rough side of LA. Yeah. So I was there and I started having some symptoms that couldn't necessarily be explained. And I was very active at the time. I had just tried to climb Mount Whitney, which is the tallest mountain in the continental United States, over 14,000 feet tall.
Oh, yeah.
So I had just tried to climb Mount Whitney. I had done it before and I started having trouble breathing. And so my whole, everything just started deteriorating from there. I got admitted to the hospital. They diagnosed me with pneumonia and pericarditis, which in a 29-year-old, why would I, otherwise totally healthy, why would I have pneumonia and pericarditis at the same time? So they sent me home and I just got sicker and sicker. And within a few days, I ended up back in the hospital. And they diagnosed me with cancer, but it, after actually an extended period of time, I had a little birthday party on my 30th birthday in the step down, and then they transferred me to the ICU. And then the next day they tried to do a bronch, which is an evaluation of your lungs, and they could never take out the tube after that. Okay. So I ended up on intubated on a tube.
On ventilation. Yeah.
On ventilation in the ICU. I was there for about a week, week and a half. I'm not 100% sure because I was out. And in that time, they determined that I had this stage 4B cancer. And
4B, this is not so much the terms that we are using. So I also had to look that up. That's like as far as you can go, basically.
Yeah.
Right?
It's as far as you can go. So there's 4A, 4B. 4B is as far as you can go. There's no 5. 5 is death. So, you know, and I don't mean to be...
That short time frame.
Flippant. Oh, yeah. I progress very rapidly within weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess everything I do with gusto, including try to die, I guess. Within weeks. So I think that I was on the vent within 2 weeks after climbing Mount Whitney.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why the picture was so confusing, because people with anaplastic large T-cell lymphoma don't typically get ARDS, which is acute respiratory distress syndrome, which is what my lungs filling with fluid,
yeah,
which is why I was intubated. And people who are 29-year-old females don't typically get this cancer to begin with. It's usually elderly males. You know, there's a lot of things that didn't make any sense. And so the approach to treating it was also a very difficult thing for them to manage. Ideally, you would never give anyone with ARDS chemotherapy because that would kill them immediately. But they had tried absolutely everything else, and my oxygen requirements were going up and up and up. And they gave my family a choice, and they said, you know, she could have a few days left under certain circumstances if we just let things progress. We could extubate her, which means pull the tube out, withdraw care, and then she could have maybe 12 hours left. But if we try chemotherapy, it might save her.
Mm-hmm.
But if it kills her, which is what chemotherapy normally does for a patient with ARDS, mm-hmm, it'll happen within minutes. So friends and family gathered from all over, and they brought me out from the propofol, which is the medication they are keeping me sort of in a coma.
Yeah.
Okay. So they brought me out from under the propofol, and I just saw 25-30 people in the ICU room. Only two allowed, of course.
Do you have memories of that situation?
And that's the only memory I have.
Okay.
Is coming out, and there was this African American nurse with braids, and each braid had a different color in it, and it was, she had the biggest, broadest smile. She just exuded warmth and mm-hmm, love. And then an Asian chemotherapy nurse next to her who was in training, and the two of them brought me out and said, we're going to try chemotherapy on you. And everybody is here. And I looked around and my whole family was standing there. And we have your permission to do this?
What a tough decision for everyone to make.
Of course.
For your family. And
if it was going to work,
mm-hmm,
then it was going to work. But if it wasn't going to work, I was going to die right there. It was going to kill me within, you know, minutes. Within the hour.
Yeah.
So they were all there. They gathered and it didn't kill me. And I, believe it or not, I was off the vent 14 hours later. And then that's how my 2 year reset started. And in that 2 years, I had 6 rounds of chemotherapy and I had a bone marrow transplant at City of Hope with the world's most amazing doctor, Dr. Stephen Foreman, who is one of my heroes. He's the hero who got me through that stage in my life.
Kudos are going out.
Oh, gosh, he's amazing. Yeah. So I still go to the bone marrow transplant reunion every single year. And that's when the bone marrow donors get to meet the transplant recipients.
So you know who was your donor?
Actually, I had an autologous transplant. So because of the type of cancer I had, because I was young and otherwise healthy, I was able to donate to myself. So I went through, and that's why I was able to go back to work and able to live a normal life and talk to people without a mask on and things like that. So I got to a cancer-free state after 6 rounds of chemotherapy. And then I donated my own stem cells. And then they grew the stem cells in a lab. And then they took me through the transplant process, killed off my body, and then gave me the transplant. And then I was in the hospital for about a month. And then I had lots of complications. So I was in and out of the hospital for 2 years. But that was definitely my first restart. So,
It's so amazing what a body can endure and what a body can get itself out of.
Yeah.
I mean, 4B and all of what was done to your body. And you're sitting here, you're looking great, you're looking healthy. And you could start with your life again.
Yeah.
So it's really amazing what we are made of. Like, we are strong.
It is. We are. We're very strong. And I think that, you know, going back to what I said earlier about triaging when your life is falling apart, going through the ABCs and the 1-2-3s, you know, back then it was, okay, my whole world has to be focused on surviving this cancer.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean? That means that when I came out after my transplant, I was unconscious or semi-conscious, I should say, for probably a week after my transplant. And I remember the very first thing was, okay, I'm a doctor, so this discussing this stuff doesn't gross me out, but I hope your podcast folks agree with me. But my very first goal was to be able to get my Foley catheter out because
step by step.
Step by step. So I started wiggling my ankles, you know, and wiggling my wrists and starting to just sort of move my feet and my hands around. And I went from being unable to even lift my head to moving enough to being able to sit upright. And then, of course, I was on tons of medications that were altering my blood pressure and making me dizzy. So then you spend some time being able to just sit upright. And then you throw your legs around to the side of the bed.
Success.
And then you know, and then you can transfer yourself from your bed over to the little potty they put next to the bed, right?
Yeah.
And then eventually you can walk all the way to the bathroom, right? Eventually they let you out of your room because I was in isolation if I was wearing a mask. So for every single day that I was allowed out of my room, I would do one full lap of the nursing station. And it got to the point where I think I got up to like 30 laps of the nursing station and my mom started complaining. She goes, "Can we just go back to your room and watch TV? I'm done with this walking." And then I got home and then I was like, okay, now I have to walk around the block and then I have to walk around two blocks and then I have to walk around 3 blocks. And so you go from being unable to sit up to 6 months later, I ran a marathon. Actually, it was a half marathon. Yeah.
6 months.
Yeah. So 6 months after I got out of the hospital, and to say run might be a little bit of an exaggeration. Walk jogged is probably more accurate. But
given the short time frame, walk jog.
I walk jogged a half marathon with my dad.
Yeah.
And actually, that's one of the pictures that I saved.
It's an immense goal.
Yeah. And then a few months after that, I trained for a full marathon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So talking about determination, right?
Yeah. So
setting
it's about
yourself goals and...
You know, it's a stepwise approach to rebuilding your life. And it doesn't matter if it's rebuilding your life after a major illness and saying my goal has to be to be able to walk to the bathroom or to walk around the block or to, you know, do a half marathon. And for me, I knew I wasn't going to be strong enough to go back as an emergency medicine physician with the intensity of our job and the intensity of the hours and the intensity of the physical work that it requires as well, unless I was able to do something like a half marathon.
Oh, okay.
So that's why I set that as my goal.
Yeah, this was your block piece enabling you to go back to the work that you love to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you manage, right? You're still doing this intense work.
Yes.
And you still love it.
Yeah, I do. I've taken some administrative time off because unfortunately the fire has created a massive pile of paperwork.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I've been taking some time off, but I would really like to get back.
You will.
As soon as I can, because I love my patients. I love my colleagues and I want to get back to my life.
Yeah.
And I think that getting through these piles and piles and piles of paperwork, that's the first step.
Yeah.
Getting through the PTSD from the fire is, I'm not quite there yet.
Yeah.
But that's also one of my, you know, segment intending steps right now is I'm going to, you know, EMDR, which is a type of trauma therapy. And I'm going to that every week, sometimes more than one time per week in order to try to get through the PTSD from the night of the fire.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You told me when we were having our first talk that you lost two of the most elementary things in your life. Like you lost your health, which is elementary and we probably all do not appreciate enough.
Yeah.
And then you lost the shelter of your home. You lost not only the heirlooms and not only the things of value, but you lost the safety and security of a roof over your head.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is completely understandable that you need to rebuild brick by brick, not only this house, but your entire pieces of life.
Yeah.
And would you say that these two experiences changed your perspective, or in which way did they change the perspective on life itself for you?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, I had a sort of an innate sense of spirituality growing up. And that innate sense of spirituality was trained out of me by becoming a doctor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that getting sick with cancer and then having the subsequent experiences that I've had has brought me back to a sense of spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's spirituality can be different. And I'm not for a single second going to tell anybody what to believe in. But I think that I have found something deeper in my core that helps me move through difficult times.
Mm.
Okay. Everybody thinks of it differently. So for the Buddhists, for example, there is a soul and that soul gets passed on from body to body. And the body is your physical manifestation in this lifetime. Okay. If you're Eckhart Tolle, you know, you have the being. And then on top of the being are the forms.
What does Eckhart Tolle?
A spiritual. No, he's a spirit. He's like a New Age spiritual leader.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Never heard of him.
He's
okay.
Actually, I believe he's German. So
if
there's.
Okay.
Yeah. There's the being. He writes in English, so I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
There's the being. And then on top of the being are the forms. And the forms are the parts of your life that are rooted to the superficial, okay? So your body and your body image, your stuff, like your house, your possessions, even your thoughts are forms.
Mm-hmm.
And your thoughts aren't necessarily reflective of who your being is. Sometimes it's just you getting wrapped up in all the monkey mind about the world, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So if it's Christianity, then you're talking about your core being. And, you know, on top of that is your sin, right? So I think that every spiritual practice has the idea that who you are in your core is the most important.
Mm-hmm.
And that all of the physical forms, whether or not it's your physical body and your health, your stuff, your house, all of these things are less important if you can feel secure in your own soul.
Within yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that my experiences from cancer all the way through my life to this most recent experience after the fire has really brought me to a place of core, where my core being is being challenged, mm-hmm. but I'm also finding strength there as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that every time I've had to rebuild, and we've talked about two of those times, there are others.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I've had to rebuild my life, I have to go back to that core being and say, who am I? What's important to me? And how am I going to rebuild this life with or without the stuff, with or without the house?
Yeah.
You know, but what's important truly to my soul and to my core being?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. This is quite a finding or quite... One of my next questions would have been, is there something like a recommendation that you can give to others based mm-hmm. on this experience? But you basically already gave the
yeah.
answer that it's like finding this in yourself.
Yeah.
You can continue because giving up is not an option.
Giving up is not an option.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not. I think that we can love and find support in the people around us and the relationships, the core relationships around us. Ultimately, everything out there is fleeting.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff, the people, the relationships, everything is fleeting to a certain extent. I am incredibly close to my parents, but at some point my parents will pass away,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? So I have to be in my core strong enough to deal with that,
mm-hmm.
right? I have been, you know, I have gone through a divorce.
Mm.
And so the betrayal of somebody you feel like you're closest to in the world is another time you have to step back and say, okay, who am I in my core?
Mm-hmm.
And how am I going to deal with this? And so I think with each challenge that I've faced in my life, I've gotten better at it. At the beginning, I was definitely not as good at it as I am now.
More challenges than people normally have to deal with, Brecken. So I'm glad that you find or that you have this finding for you, but still, I mean, it was a lot. It was really a lot.
It's been a lot. Yeah, I know. Everyone tells me we should write a book about it.
Yes. I was like, the story of your life could fill a book.
Yeah, I know.
I hope you take notes.
Yeah.
I mean, you get a podcast of some of the
stories. There we go. Yeah.
In case you want to use it sometime. But this really could fill a book. And you, I must say, it's so touching how you tell the story. So you're really good at that. You should
really think
about taking this all down. And
Well, if I could help anyone get through something, you know, I think that my life has been challenged with health. My life has been challenged with intimate relationships. And my life has been challenged with safety. And those, for most people, I would say are the three core parts.
The pillars of what your life is all about, right? If one is challenged, it's hard enough, but all three of them, or having all three of them challenged, is like really something.
Exactly. And as I progress through my life and face more challenges, I'm hoping the challenges will slow down a little bit. Right now they're coming every 9 years. It's a little odd that it's in the 9 year mark. I'd love to go for at least 18, maybe more without, without any more dramatic challenges.
Yeah, but you said that like you're making your strong, you're making your core very strong. So maybe this helps in this, that it gets more stable and that.
Yeah. Well, I think Buddhists believe that you're, and I'm not Buddhist and I'm not an expert in Buddhism. I just want to put that out there. But my knowledge of Buddhism is that we have a soul and our soul's goal is to progress through different stages and become more and more enlightened. And as we become more enlightened and better people, we are able to shed some of those extraneous, what Eckhart Tolle would call forms, right? He's not a Buddhist, but, you know, a lot of these theories are very similar, or at least compatible, I should say. So we're able to shed. So am I shedding some of these forms? Maybe I am. You know, I shed a house that I absolutely adored. It was my dream house.
Yeah.
I shed generations and generations of heirlooms that are my tangible history and the tangible history of my family.
Mm-hmm.
Will that bring me closer to a place of enlightenment? I don't know. That's up to me. And that's what I have to try to achieve.
That's what life will show you.
Yeah, that's what life will show me. Exactly.
I found something, I think it was in this placement that you did, that you have a family motto. The Armstrong clan has a family motto. And
yes.
I really like this so much.
Yeah.
And the motto is, we remain unvanquished.
Yes.
So I have to translate this immediately for my German-speaking listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Wir bleiben unbesiegt.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this so strong and so powerful. That you say, no matter what happens, we remain unvanquished. Mm-hmm. And I really hope for you and for the family that this really remains, that you
stay
strong, that you can really find strength and take it on from here.
Thank you.
I really wish this would happen.
Thank you.
So let us take one look, or let us take one look into the very future. If you receive an email from the future that's dated January 2035.
Mm-hmm.
So like 10 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the sender is Brecken Armstrong.
Okay.
So what's the subject line of the mail?
Oh. You've got this. You've got this. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. You can do this. Things feel unmanageable. The unthinkable has happened. The unimaginable, to quote Hamilton the musical, the unimaginable has happened, but you can do this. You can put the pieces back together again. Life might look different, right?
But you got this.
But you've got this. And Darwin said it's not the strongest who survive. It's those who are most adaptable to change. And so I think that as long as I'm adaptable, and I'm willing to accept change, then I can get through this too.
Very strong last words, Brecken. Thank you so much for sharing all this with me, for sharing your story in my podcast. It
Thank
was very, very emotional.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm really thankful for you being so open and for sharing this private story from you and your family.
Yeah.
And I really hope and pray for you and for the Armstrongs that you're staying strong and that it goes only hill upwards from now on. And in 2035, you'll say, hey, we really got this. And I really, really feel that I would like to hug you.
Oh, I'd love to hug you too.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. You're such a great person.
Thank you. We enjoyed this.
Yeah.
Can I show you some of the fun stuff we found
Absolutely.
In the ashes?
And
all right.
So, bye-bye.
Ooh, my leg fell asleep.
Wenn dir diese Folge gefallen hat, abonniere den Podcast einfach auf dem Podcast-Kanal deines Vertrauens. Wenn du noch mehr wissen möchtest, folge den Work-Life-Stories gerne auf Instagram. Ich freue mich, wenn du bei der nächsten Folge wieder einschaltest. Bis dahin, bleibe gesund und optimistisch, deine Mona Rüssmann.